This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Happy Thanksgiving. Today, we have repeats of two interviews about history and race. Coming up, historian Tom Dietz tells us about the man who broke the color barrier on the football team at what is now Western Michigan University. But first, this summer, Bridge examined how government maps and reports from the 1930s set in motion segregation in Kalamazoo and other cities in Michigan. For instance, the Homeowners Loan Corporation described Kalamazoo's Winchell neighborhood in the 1930s as having favorable influences. Those included transportation and good schools. Another reason to move in is that the neighborhood was restricted, meaning there were deed restrictions on the homes that kept minorities from moving there. But part of the city's north side was deemed hazardous by the same government agency because of the presence of factories and Negroes living there. Bridge's computer-assisted reporting specialist Mike Wilkinson joined us via Skype, and Tim Reddy, the director of Western Michigan University's Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations, was in studio. Reddy was among the people interviewed for the story in Bridge. The segment for West Southwest originally aired in August. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So if we look at these maps and these reports, how much can we say that federal policy drove where people lived by race in Kalamazoo as well as other cities in Michigan?
It did a lot. You know, this was very explicit. And the maps that Mike reported on and that a researcher, I believe with roots in Kalamazoo, actually came across were very explicit in terms of coding neighborhoods by the race of the people who lived there. And they were very not neutral, just the opposite. You know, they were very restrictive in terms of, you know, characterizing black neighborhoods or neighborhoods with immigrants, for example, as being undesirable, and you know, white neighborhoods as being credit worthy and you know, worthy of investing in.
Mike, you took a look at these maps and these reports. Was there much variation in different cities in Michigan, or was the pattern pretty consistent in terms of, you know, African-American neighborhoods were going to be in a certain part of town and they were going to be labeled as a less desirable place to live?
Well, the HOLC used appraisers on the ground in many of these communities, but they had overarching principles that they did apply. So some of the language is slightly different. It's not as straight in some places, but the themes are almost universal. You know, there are four gradations of code. There's, you know, the green areas, which are considered desirable areas, and as Winchell was described, was a place where, you know, it was good in part because it restricted people of color from those neighborhoods. There was blue, which was past its peak, but still good. Yellow, which was considered definitely declining. And then there was hazardous. Now, this didn't tell people how to loan their money, but it gave them a framework with which to work in terms of, you know, what was considered a good place. And what you find is in almost every single place in Michigan, in the nine cities that these maps exist, for which these exist, if there's the presence of even 5% or a few Negroes, blacks, they are in the hazardous category. There's only a couple places where they're in the definitely declining in yellow. So, you know, there were other places that were red, and that was because there were no zoning or there were lack of transportation, lack of infrastructure in the presence of white folks. But those things could change. I mean, you could add pipes, you could add a road, you could put electricity and sewer there. But you couldn't change people from not being black. So they were always put in these areas that were considered the least, not likely, but least supportive of investment. And here's one thing that I think a lot of people should understand is today, post-civil rights movement, if you're going to go buy a house, you cannot consider race. You have to consider what kind of job they have, how much money they have in the bank, what's their credit history. But what this does back in the 1930s, and this extends for another 30 years, these ideas aren't knocked out of the water by law until the 60s. These made decisions based on race alone for an entire neighborhood, not on whether you could pay the bill, the mortgage, whether you could, you know, you had a great job or not. That didn't matter. It was what color were you, and were you a desirable or an undesirable?
Tim, you say that you can look at these maps and you can see basically what's going to happen over the next 80 years based on what these maps and these reports are telling you. Draw that line for us between 1937 or so and 2017.
I think there are two frames of reference, one geographical and one demographic. And, you know, frankly, the African-American population of Kalamazoo in the 1930s, when this started, was not particularly large. Some of the areas that Mike referred to as being characterized as undesirable are predominantly African-American neighborhoods today, and very, very low income with very low property values. And there's certainly a relationship there. You know, I think that it's, you know, the way I see it, though, is I'm particularly interested in this from more the demographic point of view and the opportunity to build wealth and to build, frankly, all of the resources and human capital within families that enable people to prosper and to enter and continue in the middle class. And government policy in the housing authority from the 1930s to the 1960s, in terms of where investments were made, where what areas were worthy of investing in terms of mortgages or not, you know, were characterized by race, as we just described, and that systematically by government policy and by law. Channeled resources to predominantly white areas and kept them away from black areas. And, you know, the term white privilege is something that I try to use sparingly because I think people can become numb to it or whatever. But this is about as concrete, literally and figuratively, I suppose, as you can get. In terms of how government policy privileged white people and disadvantaged black people. And, you know, when you talk about housing, you know, for most people, your home is your principal source of wealth. Most people's wealth is in your home. And if you can, you know, if your home does not appreciate or you don't, you know, you don't live in an area where homes rise in value because you were segregated or you were confined to areas that were belittled, if you will, by government policy, then, you know, this is a very clear example of how we got where we are today, where the average wealth of African-Americans is something like $10,000, African-American families, when it's, you know, 10 times at least that for white families. And, you know, and you could look at other forms of other assets, if you will, that are important for middle class membership and participation, access to education. You know, in the 1930s, when this started, you know, it was at the start of or prior to the Great Migration to the North. You know, schools were segregated by law in the South. Access to white institutions of higher education was denied in the South, and so you know, all of those assets, if you will, or opportunities to build assets and entry cards to the middle class were systematically denied by law.
And is it fair to say, Mike, that these programs in particular were an entry card to the middle class for many white families, allowing them to own a home that otherwise they may not be able to purchase?
Well, a couple things happened right at the time that these maps were created. And the Hulk loan program was an outgrowth of the Depression and a lot of foreclosures. And at the time, you only had, when you wanted to buy a home before then, for the most part, you were going to get a 4-6, at most, like 7-8 year mortgage. And what Hulk did was it extended the terms to 10, 15, and ultimately, I think it went out to 20. So the size of the payment initially completely changed. And right after that, and that was just for rescuing existing mortgages. But right after that, the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, was created and adopted some of the same racial purity attitudes that Hulk did. And that extended loans out to 30 years. So it was basically the dawn of the modern mortgage. And this is happening. You know, we go right into World War II shortly after that. But when the war is over, the explosion in the suburbs has two things in place, has the Hulk racial attitudes in place, and it also has the FHA's long-term mortgages and the ideas on racial purity. So as we build the suburbs of Detroit, of Lansing, Grand Rapids, the only ones, not the only ones, but for the most part, the only ones that are able to enjoy that are white folks. And in Flint, one of the researchers that I talked to, you know, there were, I think, tens of thousands of mortgages insured by the FHA post-war. Only a couple dozen went to African Americans. They were not able to move into areas where whites already were, because they were trying to keep, they didn't want racial imbalance. And so it did largely fuel the suburban move. Now, if you look at Detroit, there are African Americans throughout the suburbs. They've made moves that way, that they're following the whites that who moved there beginning in the 50s. But since there was a 40-30 year head start, it still looks completely segregated. So what happened back then in the 30s and the 40s looks like it's historic. It's something your grandparents enjoyed. It set a pattern that continues today.
Well, and as you say in this story, it's going to take more than a generation or two to fix it. But you also examined some of the programs that other cities are looking into. What are some things that people are doing to try and make home ownership more possible for, say, minority groups, et cetera?
I mean, there has not been a silver bullet answer to this. Shaker Heights, Ohio, which has been a diverse suburb of Cleveland for decades, has gone to the extent of trying to help with down payment assistance to make sure it doesn't move from a 30% African American community to a majority African American. It's been very cognizant of it. It's a very liberal community that has just tried mightily to maintain its diversity. Oak Park, Illinois, back in the 70s, adopted housing policies. My sister lives there, and if you want to sell your house, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but for decades you couldn't put a real estate sign up, and the realtors were instructed that you can't steer African Americans to one section of town south of the highway and the whites to another. And so, it has largely remained a diverse community. It's, I think, 63% non-Hispanic white now. It's a little less white than it was before. But looking at the history of its peer suburbs of Chicago, it's done a far better job. But those are two small places. They're very small. You've not seen it in a regional effort. I mean, there's been talk that Minnesota or Minneapolis has done a lot of work in the last 40 years, but it's not been largely successful. That every community and then the Minneapolis area had to set aside low-income housing. They share some tax base. But despite those efforts, segregation has crept in. I mean, nowhere to the extent that you'll see in a St. Louis, a Cleveland, or a Detroit, but it is still happening.
Detroit and Milwaukee and Chicago are about the most segregated cities in the United States. Kalamazoo is certainly quite segregated, but not at that level. The Census Bureau has measures of that, and racial segregation, where we certainly have plenty of it, but not quite at the level of the cities I just mentioned. What we do have is more so than four out of five cities in the country is segregation by class. And class and race segregation do tend to correspond greatly. Predominantly black neighborhoods are almost always also very low income neighborhoods. And this really disadvantages the residents who live there, cutting them off from social interactions with potential employers, with people in networks and in professional positions, business owners, et cetera, people that white middle class people would come across in their social lives naturally, living in low income segregated neighborhoods. Again, partly the legacy of the policies we're discussing makes that far less likely to happen. And again, all of this is ongoing. One other thing I guess I would add in terms of current or recent policies in the recent the Great Recession that was related to housing policies and shaky mortgages, subprime lending, et cetera. It's well documented that even though the redlining and the restrictive covenants and the kinds of policies that Mike wrote about in his article, or at least on paper, no longer permitted, what did happen to a large extent in the lead up to the 2008 recession was that African Americans were targeted for high cost loans and again, they could afford, when you looked at a white person and a black person of similar means and resources, the black person was much more likely to be sold a mortgage that had much higher costs and was more likely to be foreclosed upon for that reason.
Something that I can remember hearing back to my youth and well into my adult years is the idea that if African Americans move into a neighborhood, regardless of who they are, regardless of their position in life, what job they have, their socioeconomic status, that is going to drive down property values because the white families there will see blacks moving in and decide that it's time to move out. Does that idea still persist today? And I'm wondering also if maybe the idea of it comes somewhat from these reports and these maps going back to the 30s.
It actually goes back before that. I mean, these maps come out of these economists, these real estate economists' ideas, these sociologists' ideas from some of the best universities in this country, the University of Chicago, the University of Michigan, who held that that was the case and that which would justify the decisions based on economic grounds. And so we've had almost a century now of this attitude, and I would argue we don't know if we can live together because we've always lived apart. So, I think it's kind of a hard thing to unravel. We don't know if it's true because we've never tried the alternative. I know, I always argue in my neighborhood, I don't care if as long as they can afford the house, I don't care. I think the problem becomes is, let's say you live in a house in a neighborhood where every house is $100,000. And someone you don't like buys a house. Maybe they're, I don't know, Asian or they're African American. But if they pay for $100,000 and you don't sell your house for $80,000 to get out, then it doesn't change the value. And I think that's what happened. We saw that what happened across the nation, the blockbusting. Someone, an African American, would buy a house on the east side of Detroit, and then every neighbor would sell at a discount and the price would just plummet from there. Well, if they paid the right price as you, same price as you did, it wouldn't have changed the neighborhood. So I don't know. It's one of those things where I think we're using, the researchers have talked about, we're almost using economics to justify our own biases and in a negative way.
Well, the biases in the housing sector obviously reflect, the history of racism that unfortunately has been pervasive in our culture and in our institutions since our founding. And we did a lot to get rid of a lot of those laws in the 1960s and 1970s, but the attitudes are still there. I think the blockbusting phenomenon still happens. Certain communities, as you mentioned, Oak Park, Illinois, for example, is one of them, instituted policies to try to keep whole neighborhoods or whole cities from flipping racially when a black person moves in. So it still happens, but I think we have to be vigilant and we have to think about what kind of community, what kind of society do we really want to live in? This whole business about, white nationalism, white superiority is deeply ingrained in our culture. This obviously is not tenable, not viable for a 21st century nation state, let alone the obvious justice and moral implications of what we're talking about.
Tim Reddy is the director of Western Michigan University's Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations. He has joined us in studio. Mike Wilkinson is computer-assisted reporting specialist for Bridge. He has joined the conversation via Skype. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gordon.
The interview with Mike Wilkinson and Tim Reddy originally aired in August. A link to the Bridge story, Michigan's Segregated Past and Present, can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. This past summer, Western Michigan University honored the man who broke the color barrier on its football team over 100 years ago. Sam Dunlap was inducted into the Western Athletics Hall of Fame in 1973. Members of Dunlap's family visited campus in July for events to honor the man known as the Black Ghost. As another college football regular season winds down and the Broncos prepare to play at Toledo tomorrow, we're going to revisit our interview with historian Tom Dietz, curator emeritus of the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. He joined us to discuss Sam Dunlap for an interview that originally aired in August. Thanks for being here, Tom.
Oh, my pleasure.
So let's start with how Sam Dunlap ended up at what was then called Western State Normal School.
The story, and this is not something I discovered on my own. I read it in some history, is that he was a standout star from Benton Harbor High School, that he was recruited by the University of Michigan, and that somewhere along the line between being recruited and actually showing up to take part with the football team at the University of Michigan, they discovered that he didn't fit their profile. That is to say, Sam was an African American. And at the time, the University of Michigan, especially its coach, the legendary, actually, for U of M, Fielding Yost, said, no, this isn't going to work. So Sam came back to Western Michigan, that is this part of the state. And Dwight Waldo, the then president of Western, was happy to welcome him. Waldo was a big enthusiastic supporter of sports in general, and in particular, football. And so I think he was happy to have a standout star come to his football team, which was in the process of transitioning from a club sport to a intercollegiate sport such as football was in those days. So Sam ended up here and supported by Dwight Waldo.
And Sam Dunlap and Dwight Waldo really hit it off, didn't they?
That is a story that has always gone along, that whatever happened, that President Waldo supported Sam. There are a couple stories about that from his football career that I can touch on, but that the friendship also continued long after Sam had graduated and had moved on. But we know that in 1917, the team went to schedule to play Culver Military Academy, and that Culver refused to play if they had to face an African-American. And Waldo told Dunlap, the decision is yours. If you want to go, we're going to support you. Sam eventually decided against it, let the team play, and they crushed Culver by a pretty substantial score, something like 79-0 or something like that. So they did hit it off.
There were some other examples of racism that Sam Dunlap faced, including from some of his own teammates every now and then.
This is true. We know. And here we should give some credit to the coach, Bill Spaulding, at the time. At least one or two recruits to the Western team at the time were from some of the Southern states, and they refused to participate, play on the same team with an African-American. And Spaulding said, okay, that's it. You're gone. You will play with Sam. They also had to travel, and I think it was in 1916 that they were playing for the national championship, such as it was in those days, for normal schools. And Sam had to have separate accommodations along the way because, well, that was the case for even professional sports into the 1950s and 60s. African Americans were not always welcome at the same places. So Sam, they had to make special arrangements for him along the way.
Does the attitudes towards race at those times show up in some of the media coverage as well?
It's perhaps the case. What I've noticed, and I have read a number of the Western Heralds, the student newspaper from the day, that whenever he is referred to in the university media, normal school media at the time, that he is Sam, he is Dunlap, that he is the star fullback, or halfback rather, or the star punter, because he punted as well in those days. And later, though, in the 20s, and we can maybe guess but reasons with, you know, without proof, but they always referred to him as colored and black. And in the number of articles, I read a fair number of articles from 15, 16, 17, I never find Sam referred to as colored or black. He's always Sam, he has done that. And I suspect this is because it's a smaller school in those days. Everybody knows each other. He's also the star, but in the 20s, people may not have recognized him, and maybe this was the way of, you know, that guy. who was the African American star.
How good of an athlete was Sam Dunlap?
He appears to have been quite the athlete. He is, of course, in the Western Michigan Athletic Hall of Fame in a number of sports, baseball, track and field, as well as football. He set records that, and here is someone who knows Western sports history a little bit better than I, but I know that in the 1916 season, he scored something on the order of 19 touchdowns in a six-game season. I don't think anybody has at least touched that average of scoring, and by rushing, that is, that anyone rushing has scored an average of three touchdowns plus per season, even in the 12-game season. I don't know that anybody scored 36 touchdowns. Some may have topped his 19, but the season's a lot longer. So he was very good that way. He was a punter. He was a runner. There is a story that in 1916, again, Notre Dame came to play Western. And even though Notre Dame won, led by George the Gipper, Gip.
George Gip, yeah.
They won 10-6. Sam was an excellent punter, did the scoring for Western. And Newt Rockne supposedly said, the legendary coach of the Irish, that he had never seen at that time a better punter than Sam. They played the University of Michigan at one time. And Fielding Yost was asked, well, why, even though the University of Michigan won, he was asked, well, why did you guys have much trouble slowing him down, stopping him? And he said, stopping him? We couldn't even slow him down.
Fielding Yost, who could have had some.
Who could have had him,
Sam,
yes.
Dunlap playing on his team, yeah, at one point.
Yeah.
So there is a year, a little break in there to his career where he was away from football for a little bit. What was he doing?
Well, 1917 was the year the United States entered the First World War, marking that centennial this year, in fact. We entered the war in April. At some point after the 1917 football season, Sam enlisted in the Army, and he would serve the better part of 2 years and return for his final year as a student athlete in 1919 after missing the 1918 season. So Sam saw his duty and answered it to his country as well.
So what happened to Sam Dunlap after leaving Western Michigan Normal School?
He obviously was going to have some trouble finding a job as in athletics in those days. He was eventually recruited by to coach a team in West Virginia, the West Virginia Academy or Institute for Negro Students, to use in the terms of the day. And he coached there for a couple of years, their football team. After that, he apparently, and I'm not sure how it came about, but he ended up with working for a career for some time in New York City, working for one of the electric power companies. And then finally returned to Western and working at Western for the last several years of his life, mostly in the janitorial services here.
But had hoped at some point to get into athletics administration, I understand from your article.
I think that's what he would like to have done. But of course, we do have the whole issue of race entering in, and the number of administrative jobs, particularly outside of the historically black universities and colleges, there were just not that many opportunities.
Historian Tom Dietz is the curator emeritus of the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. Thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Gordon.
The interview with Tom Dietz originally aired in August. We hope that you are having a wonderful Thanksgiving. Next week on West Southwest, I'll talk with Western Michigan University history professor Mitch Kashun. He's also the author of First Martyr of Liberty, Crispus Attucks in American Memory. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.